Welcome to the Not Old Better Show, Smithsonian Associates interview series on radio and podcast. The show covering all things health, wellness, culture, and more. The show for all of us who aren't old, we're better. Each week, we'll interview superstars, experts, and ordinary people doing extraordinary things, all related to this wonderful experience of getting better, not just older. Now, here's your host, the award-winning Paul Vogelzang.
Welcome to this special edition of the Not Old Better Show Smithsonian Associates interview series. I'm Paul Vogelzang, and today we are diving into the fascinating evolution of the English language with none other than Smithsonian Associate Anne Gerzan, a distinguished historian of the English language, a linguist at the University of Michigan, and host herself of the NPR Michigan Public Radio program. That's what they say. In a world where the rules of grammar and language are often debated and dissected, Anne Gerzan stands out as a voice of reason and enlightenment. Her latest masterpiece, Says Who, a kinder, funner usage guide for everyone who cares about words, challenges us to think what we know about English, pushing the boundaries between traditional grammar and the dynamic, ever-evolving nature of language. Anne Gerzan will be appearing at Smithsonian Associates coming up, and the title of her presentation is Language Peeves, Inner Grammandos versus Inner Wordies. It's going to be a great presentation. It's going to be a great conversation. You can check out our show notes today for more information about Anne Gerzan's upcoming Smithsonian Associates presentation, but we have Anne today. And let's take a listen to a brief reading by Anne Gerzan from her new book, Says Who, a kinder, funner usage guide for everyone who cares about words.
How can something that is technically right sound sometimes so very, very wrong? That is the situation we're now in with the pronoun whom. Let me show you what I mean. Given my professional title, English professor, and the fact that I study grammar and do things like write usage guides, some folks like to read my emails very carefully, looking for, from their perspective, grammatical slip-ups, and then email me about them with messages like, I can't believe that you, of all people, would write, and then they add in whatever that would be. It makes me a very self-conscious email writer. So I find myself in something of a conundrum when I need to open an email with something like, I wasn't sure who to send this message to, so please forward it as needed. Technically, I should use whom, not who. I wasn't sure whom to send this message to. But wow, that sounds hopelessly stuffy, if not pretentious or downright wrong. If I take the to and move it forward, it sounds less wrong. I wasn't sure to whom to send this message, but perhaps even more stuffy. I find myself then between a grammatical rock and a hard place. Keep who and risk people going grammando on me for not knowing my who's from my whom's, or use whom and risk damage to my social life for being the grammatically fussy English professor who is going to be judgy about other people's emails. Because it's email, which is a less formal kind of writing, I stick with who. I also know that we're living through an extended change in progress in the language, and that in the long run, whom is likely not going to survive. Some of you are probably cheering, and others are gritting your teeth. For the latter group, let me flip the tables. Rather than lamenting that whom may finally disappear, we could look in awe at how long it has managed to survive.
That, of course, is our guest today, Dr. Anne Gerzan, reading from her new book, Says Who, a kinder, funner usage guide for everyone who cares about words. We'll be talking to Anne in just a moment. And throughout our conversation, you'll note that we're going to explore the balance between preserving the rich history of language and embracing its inevitable evolution. Today, Anne Gerzan will share her insights on the primary drivers of language change, whether it be societal shifts or the impact of digital communication. We will delve into the heart of the debate over grammatical rules, the singular they, and how these discussions reflect broader societal changes. For our listeners, especially those over 60, Ann Curzan will offer practical advice on both remaining relevant in today's multi-generational world and in navigating these linguistic shifts, ensuring that language for us remains a tool for connection, not division among us all. And for a glimpse into the future, Anne will share her predictions and hopes for the evolution of the English language in the coming decade. So, whether you are a self-proclaimed grammando, a word enthusiast, or simply curious about the words we use and why we use them, this episode promises to enlighten, entertain, and inspire. Let's embark on this linguistic journey together right here on the Not Old Better Show Smithsonian Associates interview series on radio and podcast. Smithsonian Associate Ann Curzan is our guest today. Ann, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Paul. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, gosh. I have to tell you, I'm so looking forward to this. You've shared your book, Says Who, with me. I've just enjoyed it. I enjoy language. I make my living talking and reading. And so this is just right up my alley. I hope your day is going great because you've made my day by joining us today. And I wonder if we could just start real quickly, maybe tell our audience a little bit about what you're going to tell them for your upcoming Smithsonian Associates presentation and maybe how you'll use Zoom to engage our audience because we're all on Zoom these days.
We are. And there are really fun ways to do this presentation over Zoom. Let me start with a couple of facts that help inform the presentation that I'll be doing. One is that the English language is always on the move. It is always changing. It's changing all around us. I love that. It gives me a lot of material. The second is that diversity in language is part of the diversity of us. And we're going to hear that diversity or see it in the written language and notice things that may not be familiar to us, as well as language change where something may be new. I wear multiple hats. I'm a linguist who studies how language changes and how it varies across communities. I'm an English professor who wants to make sure that students can make fully informed choices as writers and speakers as they navigate all these ideas about correctness, about good usage. I'm also a copy editor who notices every single comma. I'm also a former member of the American Heritage Dictionary usage panel. So I have all these hats, which makes it very fun to talk about language peeves. And that's the topic of the presentation. What are people feeling concerned about? What do they not like in the language? So that we can talk about what is happening in the language. Is that an example of change? Is that an example of variation? Or is that an example of a rule that's been imposed on the language? In which case we can talk about, is it a useful rule or is it not a useful rule? Because as a historian of the language, I study how the language itself changes. I also study how attitudes about the language change and notions about correctness change over time. So all of that makes it very fun to talk about what we're worried about right now and what we think is right and wrong right now within this historical perspective.
This does make it very fun to talk about this right now, especially. So in terms of our language, how do we preserve it? Because there are some wonderful things about it, but it does evolve. Inevitably, there are changes. And whether you get peeved at that or not, that's another question we'll talk about. But how do you balance that preservation of the language?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts about that. The first is that in my experience, language change seems much more interesting to people in retrospect than it does when it's happening all around them. When I tell people that English used to have grammatical gender, all nouns were masculine, feminine, and neuter, people say, that's so interesting. Or all varieties of English used to have double or multiple negation. Then the standardized variety moved to single negation. People think, huh, I didn't know that. Or nice used to mean silly. Decimate used to mean to destroy one in every 10. These are facts that people think are interesting. Then you say, literally can mean figuratively. And people say, that is awful. I don't like that. The language is going to change. And I think that that's a really important perspective for us to have. Now, a standardized variety of the language can be helpful. It can be a variety that we can share across different dialects, be that within one country or across the world. That can be helpful. It can be the variety that we teach for people who are learning English as a second language or a foreign language. The standardized variety often will change, the written version of it will change more slowly than other varieties because it is more highly regulated. But one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is help people think more about all those rules that we have that are trying to keep the language in one place and get more comfortable that the language can change and that it will change and that we will have more variation and can have more variation even in the standardized variety than some people may realize.
And the book is titled Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. Our guest today is Smithsonian Associate Dr. Anne Curzan from the University of Michigan. Got lots of great details about Anne and her work, and we'll put those links along with links to her upcoming Smithsonian Associates presentation in our show notes today for everybody. But Anne, I see this an awful lot. It's very much a peeve, I think, for people, and that is the double spacing after a period. And that's a relic from the typewriter area, but it seems to get an awful lot of attention online, especially in the use of digital communications, whether that is an email or a text. Sometimes punctuation is left out entirely during texts. And so maybe talk to us a little bit about that and what that means in terms of the evolution, because that's kind of punctuation related, but it is definitely a peeve of a lot of people's.
You're absolutely right. You can find a lot of attention to this online.
Yeah.
I was looking the other day at something that said, how do you know if you're over 40? Because you put two spaces after the period and the colon.
Yeah.
I was trained this way. I was trained to type on a typewriter, and I was trained to use two spaces after a period, after a colon. This is now outdated. Computers can do proportionally spaced fonts. So they're automatically spacing for us, both within a word and then after a period. So I have retrained myself so that I am a one space person in all contexts. And I would say this is the direction to go. And just know that the computer program can help you. It's there to support you so that you don't actually have to worry about this one.
I'm very proud to be a 67-year-old, but I think the double spaces probably tip people off too. So I'm going to bear this in mind myself. Absolutely. In my research of you, I found that in your Michigan Public Radio show titled That's What They Say, and again, we'll put links so that our audience can find this as well as links to Smithsonian Associates and Anne's new book. But you talk a little bit about saying often or often, maybe preferring both, but silent sounds. You talk a little bit about going forth or back and forth. And then in the book, you talk about based off or based off of or based on. All these things caught my attention because they're more than just minor adjustments to our English language. And I think we ought to know a little bit more about these.
Those are all great examples of changes in progress. And I'll circle back to your first question of how might I use Zoom in the presentation? And one of the really fun things about Zoom is that you can poll people so that, for example, I can poll people about how many of them say often, how many of them say often, and how many of them say both. And it's actually much more reliable than a show of hands in an auditorium. You can actually get a real count of what is going on in the Zoom room. With often and often, this one is interesting because if you go back about 500 years, that word had a T. It was often. But it subsequently lost the T in the same way that a word like hasten lost its T. But more recently, we have seen, because the T is in the spelling, that people are reinserting it as a spelling pronunciation. And if I had to bet, I would bet on the spelling pronunciation, because a lot of people think that is the correct pronunciation and that the lazy pronunciation is to leave out the T, even though for several hundred years that the pronunciation has been often. Change in progress, not one that is really severely judged, I think, though I know some people are a little bit cranky about often as a pronunciation. The based off of was brought to my attention by a colleague at the university now probably 10 or 12 years ago, who wrote to me and said, "Oh, this is just something that I hate seeing in student writing. They're saying based off rather than based on." And often these come with the sort of implication and make it stop. Make the student stop doing this. And I thought, oh, how interesting. Because in English over time, we have often seen shifts in prepositions. Prepositions are idiomatic. When is it a story of versus a story about? Why is it on purpose, but by accident, right? These are idiomatic. And in fact, if you listen to many young speakers, you will hear them say on accident, which might be because we say on purpose. So as I was thinking about based on and based off, the argument against it was, if you have a base and then you're building on the base. So it should be based on. Totally fair. But I think you could make an potentially equally logical argument that if you have a base, you can jump off of it. And we do talk about jumping off points. And so it's based off that, because that's where I launched from. And I say that to highlight that we can sometimes find ourselves in these conversations about this is the correct way and this is the incorrect way. Sometimes it's this is the older way and this is the newer way. And what I hope in this book is that we can move away from these notions of clear right and wrong answers and talk more about clarity and purpose and rhetorical effectiveness and audience. Because the most savvy speakers and writers are the ones who have really big toolboxes and who are thinking about, for this audience in this context, do I want to use who or whom? That is actually a more fun, interesting, and inclusive way to think about being an effective speaker and writer.
Our guest is Smithsonian Associate Dr. Anne Curzan, who's written the book Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. The book is really fantastic, Anne, and I've enjoyed it. I very much appreciate you sending it on to me. There's a lot of great attention online for the book, just wonderful reviews. And Ben Zimmer, who is the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal, says, whether you embrace your inner grammando or inner wordy, Says Who is sure to satisfy anyone curious about language's ever-shifting landscape. Just as you're suggesting, I really love that. And I really love your use of the word grammando. So how do we reconcile our inner grammando with our wordy part of ourselves when we're writing or speaking?
Paul, thank you for the question and for putting grammando and wordy on the table. These are two great words. And yeah. Grammando, I want to credit Lizzie Skernick, who introduced at least me to this word in her column, That Should Be a Word, in the New York Times Sunday Magazine in 2012. And she defined it as someone who constantly corrects other people's linguistic mistakes. Now, I might not call them mistakes, but I love the term because I think it's a little bit playful around this act of feeling peeves and maybe correcting other people. And one of the insights that I had in writing the book is that I think each one of us has a little inner grammando in our head, including me. I'm a linguist. I study language change for a living. I am very descriptive in general, but even I will sometimes hear something in the language and think, ugh, does the language have to change that way? Couldn't it change some other way? Because for whatever reason, I find it aesthetically displeasing or what jargony, whatever it is. So we all have that. I also believe that we all have an inner wordy. And wordy is a relatively new word. Merriam-Webster put it in their dictionaries in 2018, defined as a lover of words. And we as humans enjoy language. We play Wordle or Scrabble or Spelling Bee. We pun, we rap. We enjoy playing with language. We're curious about language. So what I'm trying to help people do is have more informed conversations with their inner wordy, so that when you find yourself feeling cranky about something or wanting to correct something, that there's a moment where you pause and think, first of all, am I really right? Second, do I need to have a peeve about that, or could I get over it? Third, even if I do have a peeve, maybe I am right, or at least I think I'm right. Do I need to say something at this moment? Or is that an inside my head thought? And I'm also trying to empower our inner wordy with a lot more information about where rules come from. That's the title. Says who? That when someone says, you can't do this or you can't do that, that you can ask, not in a obnoxious way, but in a curious way, says who? Is that a useful rule? Some of the rules really are useful. They're designed to minimize ambiguity in the written language. They create nice parallel structures. They promote clarity. Some of the rules are really not very well founded, and it's useful for us to know the difference. That's how I think about reconciling those two, which is allowing yourself to enjoy and be curious about language, allowing yourself to be a more generous reader and listener, but also recognizing that your inner grammando sometimes may be providing you useful information about a place where you could be less ambiguous or clearer as a writer or a speaker. So it's just having more information to have those conversations with our inner wordy and our inner grammando.
That's good. That's wonderful. Thank you for that. So how do these changes even take place in the first place? I mean, is it societal shift that's bringing about some of this language evolution? Is it technology like the typewriter jumping to the computer or something else? Because I take your advice and I pause before I get peeved, but I see words like hangry or defriend or adorkable, you know, all cute words. What do I make of those? Is that because I'm just out of step and society is changing, or is that something else?
It's a really important question for all linguists, which is how and why does language change? The first thing I'm going to say is young people. And I say that in the most positive, enthusiastic way. There are linguists who describe young people as the movers and shakers of language. Couple reasons for that. One is that babies, infants, as they learn the language, as one linguist has put it, they reinvent it. And I think that when you think about language learning that way, you realize why it changes. A baby is hearing all of this language input, and they are then figuring out the rules of the grammar. And in that process, they will come up with some slightly different interpretations of the data than the adults around them. And an example of that would be the evolution of the word fun. And of course, I have funner in the title of the book. Well, fun for most of its life was a noun. So if you said that party was fun, it was like saying that party was chaos. Fun was a noun. We had fun. Conclusively, it's a noun. But kids, when they hear that party was fun, can easily reinterpret fun as an adjective, because you could also say that party was boring, that party was great, that party was fun. And that's what kids did in the 20th century, was reinterpret it as an adjective, at which point you can say that was a very fun party because it's an adjective. So once fun is an adjective, little kids try to make it behave like other one-syllable adjectives. Tall, taller, tallest. Wide, wider, widest. Fun, funner, funnest. That's what kids are going to do. They figured out the pattern until they get corrected. So kids are a big driver of language change, including things like slang And your examples like hangry and adorkable, these are pretty slangy words. Mm-hmm. It shows that human creativity, that playfulness with language, that is a driver of language change. There's also just the fact that if we think about what's happening right now, I am producing a string of words that I have probably never uttered in exactly this way ever before in my life. And you are listening to this and understanding what I mean, even though you've never heard these words strung together in exactly this way, because human language is creative that way. And in that process, the patterns will shift over time. And that's one of the ways we'll see change. You're absolutely right that societal shifts, technology create new words, create new demands on the language. So that will be part of language change. Another big force in language change is language contact. So when speakers of different languages come into contact with each other, when speakers of different dialects of a language come into contact with each other, that will cause shifts in probably both varieties or languages that are coming into contact, especially if you have speakers who are bilingual or multilingual. So lots of things that cause language evolution. I really hope that one of the things that this book will help people do is adopt the mindset of a birder or a bird watcher, which is that when you hear or see things that are unfamiliar, that could be because they're new, they're part of language change, or they're just new to you, they're part of a variety that you're less familiar with, that you'll, in the way that a birder would, be curious about it, try to learn more about it, think about how it works, as opposed to, which I think is sometimes our reaction, I would like to kill that.
I've so enjoyed our conversation because the way that you've strung some words together have really stopped me and made me think. And I would like to think that I can be a more generous reader. I would like to think that I can be a more generous person. And in that way, I'm a believer in language. And I think I'm a believer in the evolving nature of language to help us positively communicate. I'm a boomer. And I would like to think that I could communicate with my children better by understanding some of this. And understanding one another is what we need right now. And so I think that this is all very positive. Would you agree?
Paul, I think you just put that beautifully.
Oh, thank you.
But as we listen to each other and learn about language and allow ourselves to indulge in that curiosity that I think is there for pretty much all of us about language, it helps us connect with each other. And what a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that language can do, is connect us with each other and be that language change across generations or language varieties across communities, to say this diversity of language is part of our diversity. And that's a wonderful thing. And we could embrace that as part of our communities.
Final question for you real quick. I know you're very busy, Dr. Ann Krizan, but we sure appreciate your time. But I wonder if you'll just tell us, how do you hope or predict even that the English language is going to evolve over the course of the next, say, 10 years?
I have learned that it is very dangerous to predict things about language. Mm-hmm. There are some more local changes that I could predict. For example, I think on accident will continue to gain ground, at least in American English. I think that snuck is firmly entrenched in American English at this point.
Snuck.
That singular they will become ever more accepted in even the most formal kinds of writing. That must, in the sense of obligation, will continue to decline, because rather than must, we tend to say have to or need to. I also think that we are still figuring out what all of these technologies, social media technologies, the internet, what that means for language change. We are seeing language spread around the world at a speed that we've never seen. You think about a video or a meme that suddenly goes viral. A word can spread across the world in seconds or minutes. We've never seen that before. In that way, it's a really exciting time to be a historian of a language, to be trying to figure out what these technologies mean for how language change will spread, whether it speeds it up, whether you just get little blips and then they quickly die. That's something we're all still trying to figure out.
Smithsonian Associate Ann Krasan has been our guest today and has written the wonderful book, Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. Ann will be at Smithsonian Associates coming up. Please check out our show notes for more details about Ann, her new book, and her upcoming Smithsonian Associates presentation. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for generously reading. Congratulations on all this work. And as you do more on this subject, we'd love to have you back. I certainly enjoy it. I know our audience is going to really enjoy this, Ann, so thank you.
Oh, Paul, thank you for a really fun interview.
Thank you so much. My thanks to Smithsonian Associate Dr. Ann Krasan, a distinguished historian of English language, a linguist at the University of Michigan, and host herself of the NPR Michigan Public Radio program, That's What They Say. Dr. Ann Krasan will be appearing at Smithsonian Associates coming up, and the title of her presentation is Language Peeves, Inner Grammandos versus Inner Wordies. So please check out our show notes today for more details. My thanks to the Smithsonian team for all they do to support the show. My thanks to you, our wonderful audience here on radio and podcast. Of course, I thank our executive producer, Sam Haniger, but to everyone, please be well, be safe, and let's talk about better. The Not Old Better Show, Smithsonian Associates interview series on radio and podcast. Thanks, everybody. We will see you next week.